Last week we began this new Sefer of Tanakh, the Book of Shoftim, which is the transitional period, a period of at least 300 years, perhaps closer to 400 years, between the coming of the Jewish people to Eretz Yisrael and the period of Malachim. And the period of Shoftim was a very difficult period, and we went over some of the distinctions between the role of Shofet and the role of Melech. But today we're going to look at some of the incidents that are described at the very beginning of the Sefer. Perek Aleph and Perek Beis of Sefer Shoftim are remarkably obscure in many, many ways. There's a lot of stories that, number one, are hard to understand from a spiritual sense, and then there are things that are hard to understand just in terms of what happened. It is very abbreviated. Some of the details are actually described in Sefer Yehoshua. Some of the details are not described anywhere else. So let's begin from the beginning, just looking at the first pasuk here. The first pasuk tells us, "Vayhi acharei mos Yehoshua." It was after the death of Yehoshua. "Vayishalu b'nei Yisrael b'Hashem lemor." The Jewish people asked Bashem, it doesn't say they asked Hashem, but they asked in Hashem. We'll see what that means. Lamor saying, "Mi yale lanu el haknani betchila lihilachem bo." Who shall be the first of us to wage war against the Canaanites? So here, the beginning of understanding what's going on is that although Yehoshua ben Nun waged war in Eretz Yisrael for 7 whole years, there are huge areas of the lands that were still not conquered. Now let me just remind you of the halachic view here. Number one, the Jews are given several commandments connected in the Torah, connected to the lands. First, they are commanded to conquer the lands. That's absolutely clear. Conquer what lands? The land within the boundaries at the end of Chumash Bamidbor. Now, those boundaries essentially run much, much bigger than the political boundaries of the State of Israel, even post-1967. Now, let me point out, there is a halachic machlokas if this mitzvah of conquest even applies today. According to Ramban, we are halachically obligated to take everything within the biblical boundaries of the land of Israel and conquer it by force of arms if necessary. So instead of talking about disengagement of Shtachim, we might be talking about large parts of Jordan and Syria coming in. That's Ramban's position. See, everyone knows, just as a little digression, everybody knows the second part of the Ramban, which is very, very important indeed, but they don't know the first part of the Ramban. Everyone has heard, I'm sure, that it is the Shitas HaRamban that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah min HaTorah. This is a well-known machlokes between the Rambam and the Ramban. Ramban says Yishuv Eretz Yisrael bizman hazeh is a mitzvah min HaTorah. Rambam doesn't count it. Now, there is actually a machlokes how to learn Rambam. Some people say that according to the Rambam, there is no commandment to live in the land of Israel, although it's a great, wonderful thing. That's the conventional understanding. Within the Dati Leumi community, particularly the followers of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, they have a very different interpretation of the Rambam. They say that the Rambam did not count Yishuv Eretz Yisrael as a mitzvah because it is the prerequisite to keep all the other mitzvahs. In other words, you can't keep Shabbat properly unless you're in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore, the same way you don't count a commandment, keep the Torah. Right, there's no such commandment. In the 613, we don't count a commandment when Hashem says, keep my Torah. So, Rav Tzvi Yehuda learns, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is equivalent to keep the Torah. So, there is a machlokes how to learn Rambam's view. Some say that it is the Rambam's opinion that Bizman Hazeh, there is no mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Other interpretations learn that the Rambam fundamentally elevates it to be the equivalent of keeping the Torah. Now that is a machlokes how to understand Rambam's view, but Ramban's view is unequivocal. Ramban's view is, absolutely, there is a mitzvah of Yishev Eretz Yisrael, even Bizman Hazeh. No, the pasuk that the Ramban quotes is in Parshas Masai, in the end of Bamidbar, v'hisnachaltem osam, v'rishnem osam, v'hisnachaltem osam. And the Ramban learns that Yishev Eretz Yisrael. Now, that's a sifri that says Hashem says that the reason why we keep the mitzvos in the galus is so that we should remember how to keep them when we come back to Eretz Yisrael, which implies that mitzvos have no intrinsic holiness outside of the land of Israel. That is based on a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, where Yirmiyahu said, "Hatsivi lecha tziyunim," make for yourself markers. Now, I just want to point out, though, that while you probably have heard over the years that this is the Ramban's opinion, that Yishev Eretz Yisrael is a chi of min haTorah, I do want to point out that that doesn't just mean to live in Israel, although that it certainly means that. It also means to militarily conquer what is within the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. In other words, the Ramban has a military kibush obligation that is there. Now again, people discuss, well, what if militarily it would not be prudent and it might endanger the existing country? So perhaps the Ramban would admit a military strategy point of not doing it, but there is a chiyuv. But be it as it may, in the time of Yoshua, it's unequivocal that there's a chiyuv of conquest. That's a chiyuv number one. Chiyuv number two is a chiyuv to eradicate the seven nations that inhabit Canaan. The Canaani, the Perizi, the Amori, the Chiti, the Yavusi. It's really a list of seven, but very often one of the nations is omitted, frequently the Girgashi, because it is said that they just ran away when the Jews came and they went to Africa and the like. Now, this mitzvah of the seven nations seems to be on its face a very absolute mitzvah. Lo sechaye kol neshama. You cannot leave anybody alive. That includes men, women, and children. It is very similar to Amalek. And yet, it is important to know halachically how the Rambam has effectively redefined this mitzvah based on Talmudic sources. Because the Torah does give you a mitzvah when you wage war against a city, you are supposed to first offer them peace. Rashi learns that's only referring to wars outside of Eretz Yisrael that don't involve the seven nations. According to Rashi, wars inside the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael that involve the seven nations, there's no such thing as shalom, lo sechaye kol neshama. That is Rashi's opinion. But Rambam doesn't learn that way. Rambam actually learns that the mitzvah of kriyas shalom actually applies even in the wars of Eretz Yisrael against the seven nations. And in particular, what shalom means is the following. It doesn't mean you make a peace treaty giving them your land. that's not what's allowed. But it means that if they accept upon themselves the seven commandments of Noah, and if they acknowledge Jewish sovereignty over the land, and they accept Jewish governance, you are permitted to have them live in the land of Israel. And that indeed is what we mean by a ger toshav. A ger tzedek is a non-Jew who becomes Jewish. A ger toshav, which we don't have really today in a halakhic sense, means a non-Jew who has accepted Jewish sovereignty and who has accepted observance of the seven mitzvos of Noach. And the reason they are called toshav is they have a right to live in the land of Israel, and they even have a right to tzedakah and social welfare. In other words, they have a right to be taken care of like any other citizen. It is a right of citizenship. Now, ger toshav was not invented by the Rambam. That's in the Gemara. But the Rambam's chiddush is that the institution of Ger Toshav even applies to the seven nations. Now, in truth, textually, that makes a lot of sense, because although it seems to contradict the simple meaning of the Torah, throughout the books of Shoftim, Shmuel, and Malachim, we're always reading about pockets of these non-Jews, Chitim, whatever it is, even Amalek. They're kind of hanging around. Now, you could say, well, it was our sin that we did not eradicate them, but many Mefarshim understand it like the Rambam, that these were pockets of non-Jews who accepted Jewish sovereignty, and even if they are amongst the seven nations, they are allowed to stay. If they do not accept Jewish sovereignty or the seven commandments of Noah, then they must be eradicated. Now, so this is a big machlokas, Rashi and Rambam, how to understand the imperative of lo sechaye kol neshama. According to Rambam, it is not as absolute as it sounds, which is actually an important thing generally. Well, what's interesting is, you could say that. That's correct. However, the Rambam implies, you're correct. Theoretically, one could have differentiated, but the Rambam implies even Amalek has the option of Kriya Shalom, which is pretty amazing. And that does seem to be contradicted by the narratives in the Torah. Now, there's another machlokas. Even if you reject Rambam's position that they could accept seven commandments, what if they want to convert and become Jews? There actually is an indicator in the Gemara that even Amalek is eligible for full-fledged Geirus, because the Gemara tells us that there were descendants of Haman who taught Torah in Bnei Brak. Of course, I don't want to say the nasty joke that some people feel they know their teachers, they know who the descendants are, but okay, be it as it no, nasty joke, but okay, be it as it may. But that implies that indeed Amalek even has the option of Geiris, which is a very big Chiddush, and you certainly would not get that impression reading. And yet, let me just remind you, just a little thing, at the beginning of the book of Shmuel Beis, at the end of Shmuel Aleph, Shaul is dying in war. And if you remember, he asked his arms bearer to kill him, and the arms bearer didn't, and the pasuk seems to imply Shaul fell on his own sword. It's a whole discussion, did Shaul commit suicide or not? But if you go to the next book, Shmuel Beis, which is really one book, it's a continuation of Shmuel, you will find a strange story. A Nar Amaleki, an Amalekite youth, came to David and claimed credit for killing Shaul, even though that seems to contradict the story, thinking that David would reward him. And David HaMelech said, if you were Shaleach Yad, if you set forth your hands on the Mashiach Hashem, on Shaul that was anointed by God, you deserve to die. And the Amaleki was killed. But the implication is he was killed because he said he killed Shaul. Whole question, how can his admission be binding? Many halachic problems. But the problem is, how do you have a Nar Amaleki around? I mean, Shaul lost his position because he spared the king of Amalek. Here there's this Amaleki kid. So the Mefarshim say that the implication is there were Amalekim, as the Rambam says, who accepted the Zion mitzvahs and Jewish sovereignty, and they were permitted to live. And that's why his only offense was that he killed Shaul. It was not that he's an Amaleki that's around. Very, very strange. And again, it's not the way we normally view it, but this is the Shita Sarambam. How will Rashi learn? You're going to have a problem, because according to Rashi, the seven nations and Amalek certainly didn't have. Now, it could be, sometimes, by the way, in Tanakh, these designations are based on where you live, not on your ethnicity. So, for example, Uriah HaChiti, right? He was the husband of Bathsheba. Now, obviously, he must have been Jewish, because if he would be a guy, it wouldn't have been a marriage, and it's not conceivable that Bathsheba would have had a sinful relationship. So what does it mean, Chiti? Why is he called Chiti? Chiti is one of the seven nations of Canaan that we are commanded to eradicate. So according to the Rambam, Chiti would actually mean he was of Ches, but he or his family or his parents had accepted the seven mitzvahs of Noah. I'm sorry, more than that. Eventually was Megayer, and they were allowed to stay. According to Rashi, however, who says that none of these options are available for the seven nations, so the Radak says that Chiti does not mean he is from Ches. It means he is living in the territory that was formerly occupied by the Chiti. Now, based on that reading, although I don't think the Radak says it in the beginning of Shmuel Beis, Amaleki conceivably might mean the same thing. He was called the Amalekite because he lived in the territory that had been occupied by Amalek. So Rashi and Rambam are going to learn these designations differently based on the halachos that you apply to the seven nations and Amalek. This, by the way, is the Rambam's view is quite useful just in Kirov Rechokim. Because again, one of the big questions that people ask, and I'm not going to delegitimize the question. It is a question that we think about, and that is, we criticize those religions and those cultures that talk about jihad and talk about eradication and talk about murdering the infidels and everything else, and yet we have a Masorah within our halacha of eradicating the seven nations, men, women, and children, and Amalek. And the question becomes, how do we understand that? Well, one simple answer is that although we have our infidel class, it's very small. The history of Islam is it keeps on getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So sometimes the way you gauge a tradition, even if it has elements that we don't really understand, is are they contained to a relatively small? Because if you look at the whole Torah Shebaal Peh, the whole mahalich of Torah Shebaal Peh has always been to draw a tighter and tighter and tighter circle around Amalek. We don't know who they are, they're not around anymore, they mixed up with the other nations. In other words, Chazal are always taking us away from that type of mitzvah, as opposed to other traditions that keep on enlarging that mitzvah more and more and more and more. But all I could say is that once you bring in the Rambam's view, I'm not saying it answers every single problem we have, but at least in the Rambam's view, you see there's a whole way out, and it doesn't mean they have to convert to Judaism. They just have to accept the seven Noahide laws. No one is saying they have to wear tefillin and go to Kollel. Noahide laws. Now, interestingly enough, though, a non-Jew cannot live in the land of Israel unless they accept and obey the seven Noahide laws. Now, that raises a fascinating question about how can Christians live in the land of Israel? Because even if they're nice, moral Christians, Christianity, according to many opinions, at least Trinitarian Christianity, might halachically be idolatry, and that's the Rambam's own view in a censored passage in the Mishnah Torah. If you take out your Rambam, you're not going to find it. It was taken out in the Middle Ages. But in the original editions of the Rambam, and the newer ones have it back, the Rambam actually writes that Christianity, the worship of Yeshu HaNotzri, is halachically idolatry, as opposed to Islam, which is not, because it's monotheistic. But the short answer is that we do rely on Rabbeinu Tam's opinion, that Christianity, although it's a forbidden religion for a Jew to believe, is not technically idolatry, because there is still this belief in the ultimate father, so to speak. Of course, that doesn't explain Baha'is and Buddhists and Hindus and everything else. A little bit of a problem. But I want to point out another thing. Besides Avodah Zarah, one of the Sheva Mitzvos B'nai Noach is not to murder. So that actually means if you have a group that has not disavowed terrorism and that is prepared to murder civilians, they actually have forfeited their halachic right, to live in the land of Israel. Now, you may remember years ago, Meir Kahana, Olav Shalom again, a very, very controversial person, but a person of very good motivation. I'm not endorsing him politically in any particular way, but he was a person that did feel for the Jewish people very tremendously. And at some point, he used to advocate population transfers. Just round them up and kick them out. And what's interesting is, and even with compensation or something, I don't know. But what's interesting is, halachically, he does have a very strong case. Because if the halacha says that a non-Jew's right to live in the land of Israel is conditioned on obedience to the seven commandments of Noahide law, as well as agreeing to Jewish sovereignty, Then any non-Jew that is active in killing and does not accept the Israeli sovereignty over Eretz Yisrael, again, we don't kill him unless he's from the seven nations, and we don't know who the seven nations are. Nobody's saying kill them. But they have lost their right to live in the land of Israel. Now, politically, there are issues. You know, certain things we can't do. Like, we're not going to bomb the mosque off the Temple Mount and everything else. I mean, there are political considerations that halacha says we have to engage in. But if you analyze it from a pure halachic standpoint, Meir Kahane's view was not was very, very consistent with the halachas as we find in the Rambam. Again, whether you could do it, okay, I understand. No gedolim supported this, you know, for good reason, because it would have engendered whatever it would have engendered. Who knows? But halachically, it is not a bad. It is not at all a bad proposal. So, be it as it may, going back to the book of Shoftim, at the end of Yoshua's death, or when Yoshua died, at the end of his period, there were huge swaths of land that was not conquered. And those territories are delineated here. Now, why they were not conquered, there are many, many reasons, and it's not uniform. Sometimes we weren't able to conquer it because the enemy was too powerful. We were not zoche to be menatzeach b'molchama. We just weren't able to do it, which means for some reason Hashem did not give us the siyata d'shmaya. Other times, we were simply lazy or negligent. No, there was enough land. Remember, the population was relatively small. The boundaries Hashem gave us were bigger than we actually needed at the time. So there was an attitude among some segments of the Jewish people that, you know, we don't have to conquer this now, we can wait later, which of course was an avera. So there was negligence. A third grouping was that even territories that were conquered, the Jews made various peace treaties and covenants with the nations, not in accordance with the halacha of the seven mitzvahs. They just like let them stay as long as they weren't actively harassing. And that was an iser d'oraisa of not either killing the nations and not making a bris with them, etc. So we have many, many situations here. Some land was not conquered because we weren't strong enough. Some land was not conquered because of rashlanut. We just figured, we don't need that land now. Other land was in fact conquered, but the non-Jewish populations continued to occupy it, and not in accordance with the Rambam's protocol of accepting the seven mitzvos and the like, we just left them alone. So, what happened in the period of the Shoftim was a very interesting transition. The original wars under Yehoshua were conducted by the whole Jewish nation on behalf of the whole Jewish nation. So every tribe was fighting for every inch they got in Eretz Yisrael. After Yoshua's time, and it's not clear who made this decision, once the land was divided to the individual tribes through a survey, right? At that point, it now became the responsibility of the tribe to finish the job. It's very interesting. In other words, the kibush of Eretz Yisrael took place in two different ways. The 7 years of Yehoshua was a national conquest of the land. The next 7 years of Yehoshua, all of the land was apportioned to the tribes and to the individuals. It took 7 years to do a survey of what everybody got. Yoshua then dies. Once territory has been allocated to Shevet Yehuda or Shevet Yisachar, but it hasn't been totally conquered, it is no longer a national responsibility to conquer that territory. It now becomes the responsibility of Shevet Yisachar. I have a little bit difficulty understanding that, because after all, we are an Am Yisrael. Why shouldn't it be Am Yisrael doing it? But there's almost an idea here, and this might be part of the problem of the Shoftim generally, that the Shvatim are almost like separate little countries which are unified by a common constitution called the Torah. But they are, in fact, the story of Pelegesh Begiva, again, I'm going ahead of myself, of the concubine that was raped and murdered, and the rest of the Shvatim demanded extradition of the wrongdoers, and Shevet Binyamin refused to extradite, and as a result, there was a war The Ramban says very explicitly, this was a political issue. Shevet Binyamin basically said, we, you know, you don't have the right to demand extradition of people. We are like a separate malchus. No malchus, but a separate country. It's very similar to the Civil War. You know, the Civil War in the United States was not fought over slavery. It was fought over the concept of secession, where every state said, you know, the southern state said, we have the right to leave the Union. In fact, I'm told, even grammatically, this is very interesting, before the Civil War, the term United States was a plural noun. The United States are interested. In other words, states, it was plural, it was not one country. It was states that were united, the United States. After the Civil War, the journalistic convention became that United States became a singular noun. The United States is interested, the concept of one country. In many ways, this is what is happening, Lahavdil, in this tikufa, where once land was allocated to a shevet, so whatever was conquered, that's gesunta hate, but whatever was not conquered becomes the shevet's responsibility, not the nation's responsibility. As a result, therefore, after Yoshua died, Bnei Yisrael asked Hashem. Now, asking Hashem is a phrase in Tanakh for consulting with the Urim V'Tumim. Remember, the Kohen Gadol wears a breastplate. By the way, this is also a common misunderstanding. When you ask many people, what is the Urim V'Tumim? They will say it is the breastplate of the Kohen that has 12 jewels. Engraved on those jewels are the names of the Shvatim. That is not true. The name of the breastplate is the Choshen, and the stones, the jewels, are called Avnei Choshen. The Urim V'Tumim is the software, and the Choshen is the hardware, meaning to say the following. The Urim V'Tumim is a piece of parchment, a piece of parchment that was inserted in the folds of the Choshen, because the Choshen had a back that folded up, and you put in this software package, so to speak. And the software, I mean, the parchment had mystical shemos of Hashem, mystical names of God. And through the spiritual power in that parchment, the Avnei Choshen, the stones on the breastplate, were able to be a vehicle of prophecy. That's why we say, for example, in the Bayis Sheni, we did not have the Urim V'Tumim. But that doesn't mean we didn't have the Choshen. We had the Choshen and the Avnei Choshen. But since we didn't have prophecy, we didn't have this koach of the Urim V'Tumim being activated. Now, Urim V'Tumim, Urim is lights, and Tumim comes from Tam, complete or perfect, because it was a vehicle of complete prophecy. And how did that work? You would go to the Kohen Gadol, you would ask the Kohen Gadol a question, and the various lights on the names of the tribes would light up and spell out what the answer to the question was. Now, there's a whole chachma here, because you have to ask questions that can be answered in very short answers. I mean, you obviously can't get a big sentence or big essay. You can't get an essay answer from the Urim V'Tumim. You essentially have to ask your questions in a yes or no format. Cain, Olo. Zemachlokos Rishainim, did the lights light up that everybody could see them? Or was it only the Kohen Gadol in a spirit of Nevuah who would see the lights of the Urim V'Tumim? So this is called asking Hashem, right? This is called asking Hashem for what we should do. And the question that was asked was, Mi yale lano elaknani? Who should be the first to fight? Who will be the role model? Because who will be the one that will show us the way to achieve Nitzachon, both politically, militarily, and spiritually? And the Urim V'Tumim answered, Yehuda Ya'aleh. Let it be the tribe of Yehuda. Yehuda, of course, is the tribe from which eventually the Malachim came, David HaMelech. But Yehuda was already known as the spiritual leader. And of course, Chazal say over and over again that the greatness of Yehuda was to seize the initiative when it had to be done, and also to be Maida al Ha'emes. This is an outstanding quality of Yehuda. That with Yehuda and Tamar, when Tamar is not willing to reveal the identity of the person she was with, and she's going to be burnt at the stake, and she would rather throw herself into the fire than humiliate someone, Yehuda comes forward and says, Sadka mimeni. And that's David HaMelech had that midah as well with David and Bathsheba, when Nathan HaNavi gives him the parable of the rich man and the poor man, and how the rich man takes the little sheep of the poor man, and what shall happen to that man. And David HaMelech says, such a wretched person deserves to die. And Nathan HaNavi says, you are that man. David says, Chatasi, I've sinned. No excuses, no blaming somebody else. That was the outstanding midah of Yehuda.
What is the source of the technique of how the Urim and Thummim work?
Where is it described? This is the Gemara in Maseches Yuma. It talks about how the Urim and Thummim works. In fact, so Yehuda's quality is moda lo emes. Yehuda's quality is also deep emuna in Hashem, even against overwhelming odds. After all, who was the one who jumped into the Yamsuf and the water went up to his neck or maybe his nose? Nachshon ben Aminadav of the tribe of Yehuda. So Yehuda is truthful. Yehuda is faithful. Yehuda was the one, huh? That's right, Kalev ben Yefuna. That's right, Kalev ben Yefuna, besides Yehoshua himself. In fact, I'll give you a little, we're going to mention Kalev later in this parak as well, but I want to mention that in many ways, Kalev was even stronger than Yehoshua. You actually see this from the narrative in a number of ways. You'll notice that Moshe Rabbeinu prays that Yehoshua should not succumb to the Meraglim. That is why he changes Hosea's name to Yehoshua. Ka, may Hashem save you from the Meraglim. Why doesn't he pray for Kalev? The answer is, the Mephorshim say, Moshe knew Kalev was strong enough. Yehoshua might falter, especially since Yehoshua is going to be the leader. So in effect, Yehoshua might think he's not worthy of it, etc., and the like. So Kalev is very, very strong. Shevet Yehuda is very, very strong. So they are the first ones that are chosen to wage milchama. And Yehuda then invites, this is interesting, because although, as I said, once the land was divided, it becomes the responsibility of each tribe to do its own conquest. They're then free to make coalitions. They could ask another tribe to join them. It wasn't a national effort, but they can kind of say, I'll help you, you'll help me. So Yehuda makes a treaty, interestingly enough, with the next older brother, and that is Shimon. Now, it's interesting that the emes is, if you look at the book of Yehoshua, you will actually see that Shimon actually does not have autonomous territory. Shimon has a bunch of cities that are primarily located in the territory of Yehuda. Why did Yehoshua do it this way, al pi Hashem? Because Yaakov Avinu, because of Shimon and Levi, who killed the city of Shechem, and they did so impulsively, so Yaakov Avinu cursed their anger, and he said, Achalkeim bi Yaakov, Afitzeim bi Yisrael, I will scatter them. Now, both Shimon and Levi actually were scattered. They were not concentrated. The Levian had 48 cities throughout Eretz Yisrael, and Shimon also had scattered cities within the Nachala, within the inheritance of Yehuda. Now, Rav Hirsch points out, though, that although in indeed Yaakov Avinu's instruction, don't keep them together, because it's like a time bomb. Keep Shimon in mass, or Levi in mass, or together they could explode. Keep them separate. Dilute their numbers. But indeed, it's very obvious that the fate of Levi is very different than the fate of Shimon. Levi became elevated to be the Meshorsim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. From the Leviim came the Kohanim. Levi did not sin in the Chet HaEgel, and therefore they replaced the holiness of the firstborn. So Levi, in effect, was elevated. Levi turned its zealousness into a holy direction, a direction of Kedusha. Shimon was not Zocha to that same extent. By the way, Rav Hirsch has a beautiful, interesting interpretation which has some political ramifications. Achal kem bi Yaakov, afitzeim bi Yisrael. Divide them in Yaakov, scatter them in Yisrael. Rav Hirsch says, Yaakov refers to the Jewish people in Golus, when we're the heel, we're like stepped upon, we're like the lowly, lowly person. Yisrael, which comes from Yaakov fighting with the angel, is triumph and strength and victory. That's when we're living in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Hirsch points out, the qualities of Shimon and Levi are actually very necessary in the diaspora. In the diaspora, when you live with a hostile environment that tries to destroy Jews and undermine Judaism, you actually need the zealousness and strength of Shimon Velevi. So Achal Kaim, Rav Hirsch says, doesn't mean dilute them, but it means spread them around so there'll be a lot of pockets of Shimon and Levi to do positive and constructive things. Afitzeim, however, implies scattering is to weaken their influence. In Eretz Yisrael, he says, it's better to weaken the influence of zealousness because you have a Jewish society, and to have people who are too zealous can sometimes create chilul Hashem. An interesting comment, I won't comment further, but Rav Hirsch at least pointed out that zealousness is a quality that might be more appropriate in a Golus society. You know, some will say modern state of Israel, whatever, you can call it different ways, but this is Rav Hirsch's difference between Achal Kein bi Yaakov, Afitzeim bi Yisrael. So be it as it may, there is a coalition here formed between Yehuda and Shimon, which makes a lot of sense, since Shimon's own cities are in the chalek of Yehuda. And here we have the first very, very difficult story in Shoftim to understand, that they captured, they had a war in Bezek. I guess this was a telephone strike or something, no? sometimes we feel like making a war against Bezek. But it says there was a town, Bezek, that they captured, and they were able to smite 10,000 people, so it was a major military victory. And they found the king of Bezek, who was quite logically called, this was a title, Adoni Bezek, right, the master of Bezek. And he tried to run away, he escaped, and they apprehended him. And here it says, they cut off his thumbs and his toes. They mutilated him. They didn't just kill him, in fact they didn't kill him initially, they mutilated him. And what's interesting is that Adoni Bezek seems to have accepted this in relatively good nature, because in Pasuk Zion he says, behold, there are 70 kings whose thumbs and toes I cut off, and they were crawling under my table like little animals because they really couldn't walk, eating the scraps that I would throw to them. As he was a great conqueror, and he debased and humiliated and mutilated 70 kings, Adoni Bezek says, and now Hashem has brought to me that which I have done to others. See the Kadin, Adoni Bezek. And it says he eventually died, and where he died was, he died in Yerushalayim. Now keep note of that, because that's going to raise a tremendously difficult thing, that they brought him to Yerushalayim, and that's where he died. Now the Mefarshim all talk about this. We don't have a lot of Chazals on this, unfortunately. But the Mefarshim do make the point that even when there's a mitzvah to kill an enemy, like Amalek or the Seven Nations, there is normally a very strong iser against torture and mutilation. Now granted, we do accept the principle of torture if it's necessary to save other lives. A very good example, this is a contemporary, you know, if you have a terrorist, and through torture you could get information that could save innocent lives. As you know, this is a big controversial issue in the United States. Halacha would allow torture, assuming it is a mechanism of getting accurate information. There's a whole debate in the intelligence community whether torture is effective. But if we recognize torture at all, we do not recognize it as a form of vengeance. We recognize it as a pikuach nefesh, a way of getting information. But to simply take a prisoner, even if he's a king who's killed Jews, and mutilate his body, The poskim all say that is normally forbidden. If it happened here, it was a one-time thing that's called Horas Shah. Horas Shah means Al Pi Hashem. They were told to do this. But the Mefarshim don't fully clarify what is the idea of the Horas Shah, but presumably it would be so that the Kananim would understand the idea of Mida Keneged Mida, to see that it's precisely what you did to others that will come back and be the source of your downfall. Look at that. In other words, he did this to 70 other kings, non-Jewish kings. And he understood. In other words, it's kind of an amazing thing in a way, because he basically says, Kasher Asisi, Kain Shilem Li Elokim. What I did is what Hashem has given me back. And he was brought to Yerushalayim, and he died there. And the next pasuk emphasizes that the Bnei Yehuda fought in Yerushalayim. They conquered it. They smote the inhabitants, Lefi Charev. By the way, the phrase, an interesting thing, Lefi Charev. Lefi Charev means with the mouth of the sword. The mouth of a sword is the blade. But sometimes it says Becharev. And sometimes it says Lefi Charev. So some of Farshim want to say a very beautiful thought. That, you know, if you remember, when Yaakov disguised himself as Esav, and Yaakov comes to Yitzchak to get the bracha, so Yitzchak says, Hakol Kol Yaakov. The voice is the voice of Yaakov. And the hands are the hands of Esav. The hairy arms are the hands of Esav. And some say that maybe the voice is the voice of Yaakov, not because of the sound of the voice, but because he uses the name of Hashem, etc. Esav doesn't use the name of Hashem. But the Gemara says in Gittin that Yitzchak's words are also prophetic. Hakol. Whenever you see the power of the voice, the power of prayer, that is the power of Yaakov. Yaakov's power, even in Milchama, will come through the koach of the kol, Torah and Tefillah. Yadayim Yidei Esav. Physical might is the province of Esav. So some Mefarshim want to say the reason why the biblical idiom couples Lefi Cherev is to be merames that the koach of the cherev depends on the koach of the peh, that it is the power of prayer, Hakol Kol Yaakov. So yes, I understand that grammatically Lefi Cherev just means by the blade of the sword, but midrashically the coupling of the word pi with the word cherev will call to mind that chazal Hakol Kol Yaakov. Again, possibly relevant regarding the Giyus issues that we face. Once again, that Klal Yisrael needs an army. We need a military strategy. But ultimately, our Yeshua militarily also depends on the power of Torah, the power of Tefillah. And that's the idea of Lefi Charev. But be it as it may, what does Pasuk Ches tell me? Pasuk Ches seems to tell me they conquered Yerushalayim now. Right, they conquered Yerushalayim now. Now, the problem with this is just 1 second here. If you have a shoftim, look at Pasuk Chaf Aleph, because I just want to show you a Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Pasuk Chaf Aleph says, V'yes ha-yevusi yoshev Yerushalayim Lo horishu b'nei binyamin b'Yerushalayim ad hayom hazeh. So Pasuk Ches and Pasuk Chaf Aleph seem to be contradictory in a number of separate ways. Pasuk Ches tells me Yehuda conquered Yerushalayim v'yakua l'fi charev, it smote the enemies that were living in Yerushalayim, and Yerushalayim was conquered. I then read, now of course, who conquered it? Yehuda, it says. Yehuda with Shimon. I then read Pasuk Chaf Aleph that says, Binyamin, where does Binyamin come into it? Binyamin was not able to get rid of the Yevusi ad hayom hazeh. And let me remind you as well, if you go into the book of Shmuel, you see even a more big of a problem, because it says that until David HaMelech's time, it was David HaMelech, right? Certainly, that's the municipality here, right? We celebrate, when we say we celebrate 3,000 years of Jewish presence in Jerusalem, we're not counting from the book of Shoftim. We are counting from the kibush of David HaMelech. So what was it? Did Yehuda conquer? Binyamin didn't conquer? And then David did conquer? Which was it? So the Mefarshim explain, again, this is just lafi pshat, that Yerushalayim had a number of districts, a number of strongholds. And Yerushalayim as well is very interesting. Yerushalayim is actually divided among two tribes. Part of Yerushalayim is in the chelik of Shevet Yehuda. Part of Yerushalayim is the chelik of Binyamin. Now the part of Binyamin was called Yavus. Yavus was the part that was occupied by Yavusi, although I'll tell you a pshat there in a moment as well. So Yehuda conquered his chelik. Binyamin was unable to conquer the stronghold of the Yavusi, and that conquest was completed by David HaMelech in the book of Shmuel. All right, so that's the simple interpretation. But then I want to share with you a Rashi, because Rashi brings a very important medrash. Rashi says that Yavusi does not mean Yavusi. It was called Yavusi because that was the territory of Yavusi. But in reality, the nation that was occupying the area called Yavus were actually the Philistines, the Plishtim, and they were the descendants of Avimelech, Melech Plishtim. And if you're Avimelech, Melech Plishtim, and if you remember in the Torah, Avraham made a treaty with Avimelech. And the language of that treaty was, Im tishkor li, you will not betray me, ula nini, ula nechti, and even to my grandchild, and one more generation, great-grandchild. So there was a covenant that Avram had made with Avimelech that would extend, actually, I'm sorry, it was Yitzchak made the, this is Be'er Sheva, yeah, Yitzchak made the covenant, that would extend to the great-grandson of Avimelech. Now, this is hundreds of years later, but it's brought down that there's some old great-grandson of Avimelech that is still living in Yerushalayim. And therefore, the tribe of Binyamin was not allowed to dispossess those Philistines from Yerushalayim. And what happened in David HaMelech's time was that the last generation of Avimelech's descendants died. That's the medrash that Rashi brings. It's kind of reminiscent of, you know, what happens in New York City sometimes when they want to condemn a rent-controlled building and put up a hotel. So they manage to get rid of everybody, but there's like some 100-year-old woman like who's not leaving no matter what. So Avimelech had this old guy that was still around, and as a result, the conquest of Yerushalayim could not be complete. By the way, that was a very significant part of Yerushalayim that included the Harabayas. So actually, the truth of the matter is that David HaMelech was not allowed to build the Mikdash even after he had the Harabayas, but until Avimelech's descendants could be, until they were gone, the Harabayas itself was not under our possession. So that's how the Radak and the other Mefarshim reconcile Pasuk Ches that says Yerushalayim was conquered with Pasuk Chafalef that says it was not conquered, and the story in Shmuel that David HaMelech conquered Yerushalayim. Yeah.
Maybe I'm being a devil's advocate, but what we know from Sefer Shmuel and from the law subsequently is the Plishtim lived on the coast.
Yes. That's correct. No, that is correct. The Plishtim had five cities on the coast: Ashkelon, Ekron, Gaza. But it happened to be, for whatever reason, Avimelech's own descendants gravitated inland to Yerushalayim. It was a small group; it was not a big group. But because of that, they were immune, and they could not be attacked. Okay. Now, the next story I want to share with you is a story that goes on and talks about Chevron being conquered. And Chevron was given specifically to Kalev ben Yefuneh. Meaning, he did not participate in the general division of Eretz Yisrael, which was lottery. Rather, al pi Hashem, he was given the city of Hebron. And the reason is because, if you remember, when the Meraglim went to Eretz Yisrael, Kalev went to Hebron to be mispalel, that the Zechus of the Avos and the Imahos should protect him and Klal Yisrael from the chait of the Meraglim. And because he was makir and machshiv Hebron as a makam of tefillah, it was given to him as a gift. That became the city of Kalev ben Yefuneh, as well as some other parts as well. But then we move to a second city, and here we have a beautiful medrash. Again, the psukim are going to be so enigmatic, but you'll see how the medrash sheds a beautiful light. That after Yehuda conquered Hebron that had been given to Kalev, the next city they wanted to go to was a city called Devir. It's near Hebron. And the original name of that city, before it was called Devir, was called Kiryas Sefer. Again, these are familiar names, but they're not exactly in the same location. And Kalev, who's in charge of the Yehuda army at this point, says, whoever smites Kiryas Sefer and conquers it will get my daughter Achsa as a bride. And the one who is credited with conquering Devir is Osniel ben Kenaz. Now Osniel ben Kenaz, we're going to see, will become the first shofet. But like George Washington, he first made his career in military exploits. And he is credited, but you'll see what the Medrash says in a moment, he is credited as the conqueror of Devir / Kiryas Sefer. He married Achsa. He became the son-in-law of Kalev ben Yefuneh. But what's interesting is, he has another relationship. He is called also the brother of Kalev. Now the Gemara asks, well, that means he married his niece, but the Gemara asks, how could Osniel ben Kenaz be the brother of Kalev? Kalev's father is Yefuneh. Osniel's father is Kenaz. So the Gemara explains they were half-brothers, that when Kalev's father died, Kalev's mother married a fellow called Kenaz, and Osniel was his half-brother from the same mother. He married his niece, which he's allowed to do. You're allowed to marry, an uncle can marry a niece. An aunt cannot marry a nephew, but halacha says an uncle can marry a niece. And then, the pasuk goes on, again, I have to go over these, then I want to show you a medrash, and says that Achsa complained about the shidduch in some ways, or at least about the land, because Osniel was given territory in Kiryas Sefer, and she said to her father, give me a bracha. You have given me desert land. You have given me dry lands. I can't get anything out of this land. Give me fountains and water, sources of access to sources of water. She wanted gulos mayim, fountains of water. And Kalev gave her upper fountains coming from high grounds and lower fountains. A bit of an obscure story. And to compound the problem, this exact story is repeated in the book of Yoshua. This isn't even new. This didn't happen now. This happened in the lifetime of Yoshua, even though it's written after Yoshua died. So the Gemara says there are two things that are happening here. It says that when Moshe Rabbeinu died, there were 3,000 halachos that people forgot. Halachos, laws. And this came because of a little bit of gaiva on Yoshua's part. Right before Moshe Rabbeinu died, he asked Yoshua, are there any questions you want me to clarify for you? Is there any shilas that I can give you an answer for? And Yoshua said, your Rebbe, I've been with you for so many years, you know, I learned everything you have to teach me. So he didn't ask anything in those last moments. Moshe died. And during the period of the 30 days of mourning, there were many, they must have remembered the questions, so to speak, but there were many answers to questions that they just forgot. They didn't remember. What did Moshe Rabbeinu say? How would he paskin? And they actually wanted to kill Yehoshua. Because how dare you not remember what Moshe Rabbeinu taught? But it mentions Othniel ben Kenaz was able to restore the halachos, not because he heard them from Moshe, but through Pilpul, through his understanding of the oral Torah Shebaal Peh, he was able to come to the proper resolution of this. So that is a remez. Yoshvei Devir, Devir is, the Medrash says, again, midrashically, is Davor, meaning they were waiting for some answer. Lifanim, in the olden days, meaning when Moshe was alive, it was Kiryas Sefer, it was like everything was in a book, everything was clear. But after Moshe was gone, they're looking for Devir. So when it says, Othniel conquered Kiryas Sefer, it refers to his ability to restore the halacha through Pilpul. Now this is a very, very significant event in the history of Torah learning. Because when Moshe Rabbeinu was alive, the concept of human creativity, so to speak, in trying to figure out the halacha, was more or less absent, because Moshe got direct answers from Hashem. And Yehoshua, to some degree, was a continuation of Moshe Rabbeinu, except to the degree that he forgot. Othniel ben Kenaz, we can actually credit him, I won't say as the inventor of Torah Shebaal Peh, but as the first active utilizer of the methodology of Psak, not based on received tradition, but based on logic and reasoning and taking the raw materials and drawing conclusions, which is how we paskin, right? I mean, a posek today doesn't say, oh, Hashem told me what the answer is. The other way around, that's not even admissible. That's lo b'shamayimi. A posek has to use his logic and his knowledge of precedent and differentiate cases that look similar and compare cases that look different, analogies. The first one who had to do that, Moshe didn't have to do that, because Hashem gave Moshe every answer. Yehoshua didn't have to do that, because most of what he got from Moshe. Othniel ben Kenaz was the inventor of this Torah Shebaal Peh. So he's the father of Torah Shebaal Peh in that way. And that is the meaning of conquering Kiryas Sefer. Now what is Achsa complaining about? So the Mefarshim say, Achsa's complaining that her husband is a Torah scholar, but he can't make a living. Meaning, you've given me dry land, you've given me a great Talmud Chacham, but I can't get any parnasa out of him. And Kalev is comforting his daughter by saying, I have given you upper fountains and lower fountains. The upper fountains are the waters of divine wisdom that flow through Othniel ben Kenaz. And from the upper fountains, Hashem will bless you with the lower fountains that will give you a parnasa as well. So this is what the Gemara says. So it's a very, very beautiful, interesting medrash that Achsa needed to be reassured that she wouldn't starve. And Kalev ben Yefuna tells her that Othniel's greatness in the understanding of Torah will bring a bracha in the economic realm as well. Okay?